The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator. My guest this week is the Australian writer, novelist and critic James Bradley, whose new book is a non-fiction work, Deep Water, The World in the Ocean. James, this is an appropriately oceanic book. There's so much in it. And I wondered if you could start by saying, what was your way into the book? What your conception of it? Where did it start?
Look, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. It's a book that I have been thinking about for a really long time. I guess the beginning of the book was that about 20 years ago, I used to go surfing a lot. And there's a kind of thing that happens when you get out behind that back break and you're there and you can feel the swell moving. And that kind of sense of the largeness of the world, of there being kind of other cycles around you, other kind of cycles of time, other cycles of kind of physicality and presence in the world. And I started thinking that that was something I wanted to write about. There was a way of using the ocean to kind of think about some of those things. And I've spent a long time thinking about it and trying to work out how to do it. But what I ended up wanting to do, I think, was to use the ocean as a kind of lens to think about a series of questions about time, about history, about the environment, environmental crisis, and about the future, I guess. And because it seemed to me that if you took the ocean and used it in that way, it allowed you to think about some of those things in different ways. It allowed you to see how a series of questions that often seem separate to us about environmental crisis, about inequality, about history, are kind of bound up together in a really powerful way.
That point about connectedness really struck me. Because if you think kind of proverbially and metaphorically, in our kind of, certainly at least in the Western and Anglo world, the ocean was sort of the edge of the world. It was definitively other. You know, it was the place where you just didn't know what was beyond it. And it kind of becomes a sort of huge metaphorical repository for everything that's non-human and not connected to us and other. How did you find ways of kind of undoing that?
It's really interesting you say that, because one of the things that becomes clear once you start looking at it is within that kind of Western tradition, the ocean is a kind of blank space. It is this, you know, as you say, it's other. It is the blue thing on the map that you need to get across to get somewhere else. And that's particularly the case once you start looking at a kind of colonial lens. No one was very interested in what was under the water. It was just about how you get across it. The only thing that mattered under the water was, are there rocks? Are there shoals? Are there things you might hit? If you talk to somebody from an indigenous culture, they'll have a completely different conception of it. You know, the ocean is part of a kind of living, continuous worldscape. You know, the ocean is a kind of living space. And you know, if you talk to Indigenous people in Australia, you'll find that. If you talk to Indigenous people in kind of North America, you'll find that. And it's a completely different way, I think, of thinking about these things. You know, the world becomes part of a kind of interconnected whole in some way. And I actually think that's a really useful and powerful way to start thinking about it. And I think there's a series, I mean, you talked about a kind of repository. You know, that kind of conception is a kind of non-space, as a kind of blank, has really affected the way we think about it as a culture. I mean, we use it as a dumping ground. We've dumped, you know, vast amounts of rubbish into it. We continue to dump rubbish into it. That kind of sense that you put something into the ocean and it's gone. That what's underneath it is kind of other to us. I think has really affected the way we think about the ocean, you know. And in fact, one of the things I wanted the book to do was to take a series of those things that happen out on the ocean that are kind of invisible to us, and make them visible. So things like shipping, fishing, that kind of industrialization of that space. So one of the things the book is also trying to do is to take those things and make them visible.
I mean, memory also seems to be a really serious theme of the book, not just in terms of deep time, but I mean, actually, you mentioned your engagement with Indigenous traditions, that there are, I mean, not just folk memories, but quite serious sort of, essentially, histories of when the ocean either was there or wasn't, that go back many thousands of years, that were kind of not really known or, you know, understood in Western science. But you're finding people who are saying, oh, yeah, you know, we have a whole series of not quite mythological, but of collective tribal memories that say exactly what happened when the ocean rose.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I did when I was writing the book was I spent time with some of the Mirning people, and the Mirning people are an Australian Indigenous group who live along the Great Australian Bight. And they are one of dozens of Australian Indigenous cultures which have oral traditions. I mean, people call them stories, but they're not stories exactly. They are part of a kind of body of cultural knowledge, which is a way of navigating and understanding the world. And these stories look back to a time or talk about a time when the ocean was much further out. So what you've got embedded within them is a memory of a time before the ocean came up at the end of the last glacial. So these are memories stretching back, say, 8, 10, 12,000 years. And I mean, in some of the cultures, these will take the form of stories about what happened when the water came up, what happened socially when the water came up. There'll be stories about something was done that altered the, you know, that resulted in the water coming in. But in the Mirning's case, there's a series of stories which are really interesting, which are essentially kind of practical. So they have an ancestral being called Jeddera, who is a whale, who is their kin. And Jeddera left blood along the coastline, and the blood became ochre. And in their stories, there was a time where they could just get the ochre. And then the ochre started to be underwater, and they had to swim down and get it. And then eventually the ochre was so far down they could only pick it up from the beach. So you have a kind of, and this is kind of different because in a sense it's a very practical memory of a kind of change in the world. And there's something extraordinary about this, the idea of memory being passed over, and we're not talking hundreds, we're talking thousands and thousands of years in a kind of oral tradition. And I actually think there's something quite instructive for us as well, because we tend to think of writing as something that's so permanent. But in fact, our cultures forget things all the time. We lose things all the time. And these are cultures which have got actual chains of transmission going back many thousands of years with kind of accurate transmission of information over them. And there's something very powerful, I think, about thinking about that kind of connection both to the past and I think to the future, because lots of these Indigenous cultures have a kind of sense of a responsibility to kind of, not just to their ancestors, but to people who will come after them and a long way after them.
Now, you describe near the end of the book the ocean as being like the world's original hyperobject. And I'm wondering, for someone who's trying to take it on in so many of its facets, you know, the anthropology, the people who live around the world and depend on it, the way it interacts with our culture and our economic system, the way that, you know, the extraordinary stuff which I hope we'll get onto about, you know, what we are learning about how fish behave and how coral behaves and what's at the, you know, deep bottom and all the rest of it. How did you kind of set about structuring this book? Did you have a kind of, you know, did you have a map, as it were?
It's a really good question. One of the things I didn't want the book to do was to be a book which in a sense had a kind of strong narrative structure. So it wasn't a book where I went somewhere on a journey and then wrote about it, because I wanted the book to be like the ocean. I wanted it to be a series of kind of pieces that kind of flowed together and formed a kind of whole somehow, in the same way the different seas and oceans do, if that doesn't sound too pretentious. So I had this kind of idea that it would be essays that would speak to each other. Once I was actually writing it, I realized that wasn't going to work. So I did a series of things about kind of building structure into the book, which is sort of disguised within the body of it. So there's a kind of intellectual structure kind of built into it. There are a series of kind of correspondences between the different chapters, but I built this kind of larger structure where it kind of begins on a beach, ends on a beach, goes to the planetary, comes back to a beach in the middle, you know. So there's this kind of sense that the book has a kind of structure built into it. But I wanted people, when they came to the book, to feel like what they were doing was having that same encounter we have when we're at the ocean, that kind of sense of the world opening out, of the kind of largeness of things. I feel like it's a very pretentious answer, but there's quite a lot of kind of structure hidden in it, because I didn't want to impose a structure on it that I didn't think was there.
There's so much in it that really is kind of jaw-dropping. And one aspect of it that really caught my imagination is in your chapter called Migrations. You describe how in the rhythm of the day, huge, just millions, plus billions of tons of biomass kind of migrates vertically in the course of the day. Can you talk a bit about that? And I mean, there's a lovely description of how it looks like the floor of the ocean is actually moving from space or the air.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing called the DL migration, and the DL migration takes place around the world in the ocean. So basically, as day turns to night, as the kind of terminator of what they call the terminator, which is the line between day and night, passes over the ocean, vast amounts of living things that live down in the darkness, so down in the kind of mesopelagic, you know, a few hundred meters down, rise up to the surface to feed. And it will be everything from zooplankton to lots of lanternfish to squid to larvaceans to, I mean, all kinds of strange things come up to feed. And it's literally like a wave of life. And it is the largest movement of life on the planet. It happens every single day. And one of the things that's kind of fascinating about it is people didn't really understand that it happened until the Second World War, when they invented sonar. And when they were first using sonar, the people using it started getting this weird thing where they could see the seafloor rising up towards them. And this was seen as a, you know, this was worrying, obviously, because they didn't understand what was happening. After that, of course, you know, there was a kind of notion that maybe you could use it to hide submarines and that kind of thing. But it's just this vast movement of life. And one of the things that I love about it, which I think is not actually in that chapter, but I was talking to a scientist who studies fish cries, because fish make lots of noises. And she said that when they come up, you can hear it. So all the fish are shouting to each other. You know, so you'll hear this kind of yipping and bopping and grunting as all of these things come swimming up to do this. And then at dawn, disappear downwards again. And, you know, it's hugely important. It's not just this kind of movement of life. It actually, you know, it plays a really important part in the carbon cycle. So all of those things that feed up at the surface then transport biological carbon down into the deeper ocean. And it plays a really significant part in ocean mixing. I mean, there are some studies suggesting that it plays as big a part in kind of mixing ocean waters as the wind and the waves do.
Wow. Now, you mentioned the fish chirruping at each other. I mean, again, that was kind of new on me. I mean, I knew that dolphins were noisy and that obviously humpback whales have these extraordinary songs, which maybe you'll talk a bit about what we know about that. But it seems like the degree to which fish communicate is much, much greater than most people would presume. And indeed, you seem to be making a chapter, an argument in your chapter about sound, that, well, not necessarily they've got language, but that they've got culture.
Mm. Well, one of the things to understand about the ocean is that if you are up in the atmosphere like us, you can see a long way, but you can't hear very far. And in the ocean, that's reversed. So you generally can't see very far. Sometimes you can't see at all because it's dark, but you can hear a long way. So lots of ocean creatures are very reliant on sound. Fish particularly make a whole range of sounds, you know, so you can hear them. Yeah, and they use these sounds to communicate. They use them for a whole range of things, basically, in the same way that any animal does. But one of the things that's become really clear over recent years is that people tend not to think about fish as being intelligent or sophisticated. They tend to think of them as being stupid. I mean, people often think that they don't feel pain, a series of things like that. But what's become quite clear over recent years is that fish are highly sophisticated. They live in complex social worlds. They, you know, they're just like birds, just like mammals. They communicate, they learn from each other. There's now lots of evidence of social learning and of culture within fish, where they're passing information between generations. So the older fish will teach the younger fish how to find breeding grounds, how to find food, a series of things like that. And there's a series of really fascinating things that have come out, one of which is about cooperative hunting between different species of fish and octopuses and eels and things. And what you've actually got there is a thing where one of the kinds of fishes will point, which there's a series of quite complex tests for pointing. Almost no animals can point, but some fish can point. But the one that's really stunning is a couple of years ago.
Pointing in the sense of a referential act. You'll say,
a referential act.
There's something over here.
Yep. So you have a thing where there's a species of coral trout and they will go hunting with sometimes moray eels, sometimes octopuses. And what you'll have is a situation where the trout are good at catching things swimming in the open water. The eel or the octopus is good at catching things that go into the rocks. And so if they hunt together, which is very unusual, I mean, cooperation between different species is very unusual, they will catch many more things than they would catch on their own. Because if something swims up to get away from the octopus or the eel, the trout will eat it. If something swims into the rocks, then the eel will get it. And what they've discovered is that if something disappears into the rocks, the trout will hang over it and do this kind of shimmy where they point down into the rocks. And there is a kind of series of tests about what constitutes pointing, because it's actually, you know, if you've got a dog, you'll know that dogs don't understand pointing, cats don't understand pointing. In fact, almost no animals understand pointing. Humans do, some monkeys do, I think crows might. But these fish pass all of that. So these, you have a thing where you have a behavior or a kind of cognitive capacity that we think of as being something that only exists in highly intelligent animals being exhibited by this fish. But there's a kind of step on from that, which is, there's a study a couple of years ago of cleaner wrasse, and cleaner wrasse are, you'll have seen them on a nature documentary, they're kind of finger-sized fish and they operate what they call cleaning stations. So on coral reefs, they will have a place where other fish come and they get cleaned by these little tiny wrasse, and the wrasse clean parasites off them, they clean dead skin off them, you know, and they kind of tidy them up. And the wrasse will maintain a clientele of up to about 100 fish, and they remember all of those fish individually. But the wrasse don't just like eating dead skin and parasites. The wrasse will, if they're given the chance, have a go at a bit of live skin. So sometimes they'll nip their customers. But the wrasse are really sneaky about this. So the wrasse will only do this to a new customer, not to an old customer who's been coming for a while, because they don't want to, you don't drive people away on their first visit. They'll only do it if they know other fish aren't watching. If the fish gets upset and swims away, they'll swim after it and try and mollify it by kind of swimming around it and trying to settle it down. But what you kind of see in this behavior is something really, really sophisticated. What that means is the wrasse is actually kind of operating a theory of mind. The wrasse is looking at those other fish and thinking these other fish understand what's going on. One of the other things wrasse will do is if they're chased by a fish, they'll swim towards its predator. You know,
I know. I mean, these coral wrasse are, well, I think your compatriots are called larrikins.
Yeah, they are. But the thing that's really extraordinary about them is that a couple of years ago, there was a study which showed that the wrasse passed the mirror test, which means that the wrasse will recognize themselves in a mirror. And that kind of self-recognition has been the kind of gold standard test for about 50 years of a kind of higher form of self-awareness, you know. So we pass it, chimps pass it, elephants pass it, dolphins pass it, and these wrasse pass it. And that demonstrates a kind of level of cognitive complexity, which I think is really shocking to lots of people when you start talking about fish, you know, because people don't think fish can do that. But fish, you know, fish are extraordinarily ancient, they're extraordinarily diverse, and they're incredibly sophisticated, you know. And, you know, we have increasing evidence that they, as I say, that they're very complex creatures.
I mean, these wrasse, you know, for me, they were almost the star of the show, because they also seem to operate a kind of behavioural psychology. Because if I'm right in remembering what you said, they say not only that they'll treat new customers first at their cleaning stations, you know, in a kind of like, you know, getting them on board. But sometimes if they want to go and have a nibble of a live fish, they'll go to somebody else's cleaning station to do it in the hopes of giving them a bad reputation.
Yeah, they'll swim to the cleaning station. If another wrasse is away from its station, they will go there and attack all the fish to kind of, you know, do damage to their clientele. I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, one of the scientists I interviewed said, look, you know, we call them the corvids of the fish world. You know, they are the ones that kind of operate at a really high level. But the coral trout that I was talking about before, one of the guys I was interviewing had worked with them, in fact, on one of those studies. He actually grew up on Lizard Island, which is a research station up on the Great Barrier Reef. But he said that, look, if you've spent any time with these fish, you know they're intelligent. You know, they hang around watching you. You know, they're playful. They learn how to do things really, really quickly. He said it's just like, you know, it's like spending time with an animal. Like once you've spent time with them, you can see how sophisticated they are. You know, you can see that they are thinking, paying attention, learning as you're kind of doing things with them. In the same way that if you're spending time with dogs or any other animal like that. And lots of these tests, I mean, we think of fish as being kind of forgetful, not smart, but there's lots of tests where fish will, lots of kind of tests of intelligence and memory where fish will, you know, outpace dogs, outpace chimpanzees, you know, outpace all of these kind of terrestrial animals that we think of as being really smart. I mean, and different fish, presumably there's different levels of cognitive ability because as with any, you know, group of species, they have different kind of environments that they live in. But across that range, you know, they're much like mammals. They're much like anything else. They're highly sophisticated.
Now, going a bit deeper down, you have another fascinating chapter about the, you know, abyssal and hadal zones that are really super deep and which, as you say, actually add up to a huge amount of the Earth's surface, or not surface, the Earth's, you know, the Earth's area, anyway. How much do we know now about those environments? I mean, I know we're messing them up because you have the amazing detail that first time someone went right to the bottom of the San Marianas Trench, he saw a tin of spam, which is kind of like, wow. But in terms of what we understand about those ecosystems, what lives down there, do we know much now?
Look, we certainly know more than we used to. One of the things we know about the deep ocean is that, I mean, the ocean is very large. It covers around a bit over 70% of the world's surface. Its average depth, I think, is about 4 kilometres. There's a lot of water, and most of that water is deep. You know, about half the planet's surface, in fact, is what they call abyssal plain, which is essentially the kind of flat, relatively featureless and very deep kind of sea bottom. So it's down, you know, 4, 5 kilometres, 6 kilometres, and it's essentially kind of featureless flat bottom. But depending on how you calculate it, the deep ocean is somewhere around 90% of the Earth's planet habitable biosphere. So in a sense, we're a deep ocean planet. We're not actually a kind of atmospheric planet when you think about life on Earth. But there are real challenges about studying that deep. I mean, it's very hard to get down there. Once you're down there, it's hard to stay down there. It's an incredibly challenging environment. The pressure is very high. It's very cold. But over the last probably 15 or 20 years, we've started to learn a lot more about it. And one of the people who's had a lot to do with that is one of the people I spoke to in my book, which is a scientist called Alan Jameson. And he, first of all, invented what they call hadal landers, which were machines that you could kind of drop down to the bottom of these things and they'd take video and samples and things and they would come back up. And then he worked as the chief scientist on what was called the Seven Deeps mission, which was a thing set up by an American adventurer called Victor Vescovo, where he built a submersible and went down to the deepest point in every ocean. And so Alan was the chief scientist on that, and Alan's been down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, down to the bottom of the Java Trench, you know, down to the bottom of all of these incredibly deep trenches. What we're discovering when we go down there is that they are, you know, there is life down there. The fish run out, you know, fish run out, I think, about 8 kilometres down because their bodies can't cope with it anymore, but there's various kind of crustaceans and worms and things living down there. And Alan, in fact, the morning that I met him, had just come back from the Java Trench, and he told me this amazing story about, he was driving along and he came across a field of crinoids, which are, they look like flowers, but they're actually animals. And they were just kind of this field of them kind of spread out, like, you know, kind of like sunflowers kind of in front of him for like kilometres. And you get the lights on them and no one's ever seen that before because there's no light down there. But he said you can see this kind of field of kind of living things down there in the water. I think the other thing about the deep ocean is we think of it as separate to us. So we have this kind of conception of it as an other place. I mean, we talked right at the beginning about this notion of the ocean as other. The deep ocean is the total other. We treat it as this kind of mysterious world filled with monsters. But in fact, it's deeply connected to us, you know, not only in the sense that the currents that kind of move the water around, move through it, and that kind of thing. It's a massive repository of carbon. So you know, the carbon cycle, lots of the carbon ends up down there, kind of locked away in the seafloor. But also in the sense that we can affect it. I mean, you talked about rubbish ending up down there. I mean, Victor Vescovo goes down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench, and there is a plastic bag there on the bottom. So, I mean, that kind of sense that we are having a huge impact on these incredibly remote environments, I think is really important.
Now, a major theme of the book, I would say, is the way that a history of extractive capitalism, of international commerce, and the associated history of colonial exploitation has been, you know, decisive in its impact on the ocean, which it both depends on and destroys. Do you see a kind of a way of, you know, fighting back against that or reconceptualizing that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think one of the things that becomes really clear when you apply that oceanic lens is that colonialism is essentially a kind of maritime phenomenon. You know, it's enabled by shipping, it's enabled by the movement of people. So, you know, the transatlantic slave trade is an oceanic phenomenon. You know, even goods coming back to Europe from all of those places. One of the other things that becomes really clear is that the kind of environmental crisis that we're in at the moment didn't begin at the end of the Second World War. It didn't begin with the Industrial Revolution. It begins with that movement of people out of Europe. It begins with the kind of establishment of a kind of extractive colonial system. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is the kind of sugar plantations. And one of the things about the sugar plantations is that they are a kind of fusion of agricultural and industrial technologies. So what you have on the sugar plantations is essentially a factory taking shape where, you know, you are using people as machines. It's a very similar process. It has the same kind of environmental impacts that you see with extractive capitalism. And what you're seeing, in fact, on the ocean over the last, you know, 30 or 40 years is the industrialization and exploitation that has taken place on land over the last 500 years, sweeping across the ocean. So, you know, you have industrial fishing pushing out further and further. You have kind of oil extraction and various things like that pushing out further and further. And you also increasingly have things like renewable energy moving out into the ocean. So you have this kind of industrialization of the ocean space taking place. In terms of kind of pushing back against it, I mean, at the end of the day, the thing that really matters is getting carbon emissions down. You know, so that is the one that is kind of central to all of this. But I mean, I think you also see on the ocean the possibility, probably not the reality yet, but the possibility of ways of kind of managing common inheritances. You know, so we've recently had a kind of high seas treaty which set aside, you know, a third of the high seas should be set aside for protected from fishing. You know, and that, whether that's effective, which bits of the ocean that will be, there's a whole series of questions about that. But as a kind of model, it's really, really interesting because it's about actually saying we can set aside parts of the world and protect them. You know, you're also, I mean, industrial fishing is kind of out of control, but what you're also seeing in some places is a kind of an attempt to kind of regulate it and do something about it and to kind of move the control of that kind of fishing back to kind of local communities. And these are, you know, these are small things in the face of the larger sweep of what's going on, but you can actually see models taking place there that will provide a different way of doing things, a kind of more equitable way of doing things. I mean, at the same time also, you know, we have deep sea mining kicking off, you know, we have a whole series of things like that going on. So, I mean,
You're quite skeptical, aren't you, about the deep sea mining? Because there is a sort of kind of way of thinking or presenting it that says, you know what, look, we don't need to use, you know, child labour in conflict-ridden countries in order to get these metals we need for our iPhones. We can just take them from the bottom of the ocean and that'll save the world. You're not quite buying that, are you?
The person behind it all is an Australian as well. look, so deep sea mining essentially involves going down to the abyssal plain, which I talked about before, where there are these nodules. And the nodules are, they grow over time. So essentially the kind of metals in the water kind of cohere around some kind of nucleus. And so you end up with these things, they range in size from the size of a grain of sand up to about the size of a potato. And if you hold them, I've held some of them, and they are what they feel like actually are barbecue briquettes. You know, they're the kind of things you put in a barbecue. and they've got that same kind of slightly porous, they're not quite as heavy as you think they're going to be. And essentially what they want to do, and in some parts of the ocean they are so thickly spread that they are, it'll look like a cobbled street. And what people want to do basically is to put machines down there that will suck them up and shoot them up to the surface, and we break them down and they are full of cobalt, they're full of nickel, they're full of various other things, but rare earths are in them, all kinds of things that we need to kind of power the green transition. The problem is doing that is incredibly destructive. So you have a whole kind of ecosystem down there in these deep ocean environments, which we, you know, it's not that we don't understand it very well. We barely understand it at all. There was a big synthesis study a couple of years ago which said it's not that we can't do an, you know, it's not that we haven't done an adequate risk-benefit analysis of these kinds of things. It's that we don't actually have, we don't know enough about these environments to even do that assessment. You know, we know so little about how they operate. What we do know is that a lot of the life down there clings to these things because it's a solid substrate. What we know is that these machines will throw up lots of noise and lots of sediment, which is going to be very damaging. And we know that those environments move very slowly, so they're going to regenerate very slowly. And one of the things, you know, so I'm hugely skeptical of the impacts of deep sea mining, but I'm really skeptical of these arguments that we need to do it for environmental reasons, because there is a kind of sense that lots of these things that we rely upon, so cobalt, you know, most of the cobalt that we use comes from the DRC. Its mining is deeply bound up with child labor, with unsafe labor practices. I mean, it's a very, very destructive and dangerous kind of process. But we do this thing where we kind of go, that's just the cost of doing business in those places, whereas we shouldn't destroy this environment. What we should actually be doing is saying, how do we push back against both of these things? You know, how do we not think that the immiseration of people in the Congo is somehow the cost of doing business? You know, that we actually put in place structures that mean that that doesn't happen. Yeah, and also that we don't get another kind of resource scramble like we've had in other places. So, yeah, I'm pretty skeptical of both ends of that argument.
There's one in your chapter about shipping where you describe the many difficulties that, you know, the extent to which everything around us, you know, zooming around the world on containers, and these containers, at least to start with, you describe, you know, they're of relatively recent inventions, in the middle of the 20th century, I think you say, and they reduce the cost per mile of shipping things hugely. I mean, at least to start with, that was a good thing, wasn't it? In the sense that it presumably, by accelerating global trade, lifted a lot of people out of poverty. Was there a sort of turning point at which it started to become damaging?
So what you see is the container is one of the really central technologies of the modern economy. You know, and it's one of the things I wanted to talk about in the book is this kind of notion of shipping is something that's essentially invisible to most of us. I have to say, I was recently in Vancouver at the Vancouver Writers Festival, and I ran my shipping is invisible to everybody line as this enormous container ship sailed past outside the thing. I don't know, perhaps less invisible to those of you in Vancouver than to the rest of us. But it is this kind of, 11 billion tons of goods move around the world every year on ships, and we don't even think about that. But what you see is that container technology kind of goes hand in hand with the liberalisation of trade, and as trade barriers come down, it allows a kind of mobility of labour and industry. You know, so suddenly you can start moving your factories offshore to China, you can start moving your factories to Bangladesh, you can start doing all that. And it leads to this kind of modern system of logistics, you know, where we have these unbelievably complex supply chains and kind of are again kind of invisible to us. You know, the sense that everything that we're touching, everything we're using has been whizzed around the world on ships and kind of built in one place and moved to another place to be assembled, and that kind of process of that is kind of hidden under the structure of the world. What it has also enabled, though, is, and as you say, one of the things that has done is lifted large parts of the world out of poverty. You have got a kind of that kind of increase in living standards across the developing world is partly driven by that process of trade. But what you're also seeing is that the systems of kind of extraction and destruction that are taking place are being enabled by that. I think that there is some kind of middle point between those things. You know, there's a series of kind of questions about what does a sustainable economy look like. I feel that that is probably one of those things that's being argued about quite hard at the moment. You've got people who argue quite hard for various forms of degrowth. You'll have people who will argue that that's completely unviable. The only thing that's going to work is some kind of green capitalism where we decouple growth from its environmental impacts. I'm not going to pretend that I know which of those two are the solution. Yeah. I think they're really...
I can't expect you to know literally
everything. No. I mean, look, I think that they are very difficult questions. That's actually not something that I could ever quite been able to resolve my thinking
there
about. I have to confess.
There is a detail, incidentally, in here which absolutely kind of jaw-dropping to me. You say, obviously, during the pandemic, there was a huge halt to global shipping. I mean, you know, when volumes went right down. But you also then say, the profits of shipping companies soared. Between the beginning of the pandemic and the beginning of 2023, the shipping industry raked in as much as it had made over the previous 60 years. How can that be?
I don't know.
You have to be shipping stuff to get paid for...
Well, what happened was they massively... Yeah, so shipping has the prices go up and down. And so what they did was they massively... I think they kind of brought their estimates right down. And then, of course, what didn't happen was what everyone thought was going to happen, which was international trade collapsed. In fact, international trade boomed. And so you had this massive kind of increase. I think they were charging, you know, I'm now going back a couple of years, but my understanding was that because they'd upped their prices so far, they made a huge amount. But, I mean, the scale of these companies is extraordinary. I mean, Maersk is something like, I think, 20% of the Danish economy or something like that. I mean, these companies are enormous, you know, and...
I think you say, don't you, somewhere, that if shipping itself was a country, its GDP would be sort of eighth in the world or something like that.
Yeah, I think it probably depends on... Well, it's not its GDP. It's carbon emissions. So if you look at the carbon emissions of shipping,
sorry.
Yeah, they're around between 2 and 3% of global emissions. And, you know, that means that they're kind of up there in the top 10 of countries. But the other thing about shipping and emissions, which is to think about, is that we all concentrate on containers, but in fact, shipping moves all of the fossil fuels. So around 40% of that 11 billion tons of goods that are being moved by ships every year is fossil fuels. It's coal, it's oil, it's gas, you know. And so it's not just that they're pumping out 2 or 3% of global emissions. The shipping industry actually underpins the climate crisis in a completely physical, material kind of way. And again, we don't think about that. I mean, if you live in Sydney, you'll see coal ships heading out, but you don't. I don't think it's something people think about very much. I mean, it's funny. My brother has a house up the coast near Newcastle, which is a big coal port up from Sydney and north of Sydney. And when you go down to the beach and you're in the water, in the shallows, there'll be all of this coal slopping around. So there'll be little bits of coal there in the kind of wash of the water. And it's one of those moments where you go, oh, look, there it is. Here is, you know, here is a kind of swamp from 300 million years ago that's been dug up, put on a train, put on a ship, and then some of it's come off that and ended up here in the water. And here's a lump of coal. You know?
Wow. That's kind of harsh your buzz if you're surfing. Now, you know, you're in Australia. Obviously, one of the great oceanic features of the world is on your doorstep, the Great Barrier Reef. And I think most of our listeners will be familiar with the idea that, you know, all is not well with the coral. And we've heard about bleaching and so forth. But the way you describe it, I mean, you've got this fantastic interviewee who, as a coral guy, who I think you say, you know, he says he's kind of actually got PTSD from you know, watching what's happened to his object of study. But there is some reason for hope in there, at least. I mean, there's extraordinary scientific stuff they're doing, isn't there, to try and find ways of helping the coral along, if that makes sense, to adapt to increased temperature. Can you talk a bit about how that works?
Yeah, so look, coral reefs are in desperate trouble. We've lost more than half of them already, and they are now just suffering bleaching event after bleaching event after bleaching event. And every time one of those happens, it gets harder for the reef to come back. You lose physical complexity, you lose biodiversity, your area of reef cover decreases. I mean, they're very serious events. And that's essentially just about hot water. I mean, ocean temperatures are kind of off the charts. It looks like there's another bleaching event now happening off the west of Australia at the moment. Essentially, the problem is that corals, water temperatures are increasing at a rate that corals can't cope with. So there is a kind of band within which corals can survive. But one of the things that's interesting about coral is that you can have the same species of coral that is living up at the north of the Great Barrier Reef, where temperatures are much higher, as living down south. And although they are the same species of coral, the one down here in the south will not survive temperatures that the one that lives up in the north, another member of the same species, can survive. So there is kind of genetic variation within species. And so they're looking at a series of techniques to try and engineer that. You know, can we isolate the genes that make that happen? Can we selectively breed them in ways that will allow them to do that? And that both relates to the coral and to what they call the zooxanthellae. And zooxanthellae is the coral are a symbiotic animal. So essentially they farm algae within themselves. And that algae photosynthesizes and the coral lives off that. And the zooxanthellae also seem to have this variation. So you can also work on the zooxanthellae and try and get ones that are hardened higher temperatures. And the notion is that what we can do is actually then introduce these engineered corals onto the reef, and when they spawn next time, that will spread out and kind of colonize new areas. Now, there are various problems with this notion, the most obvious of which is that the reef is very, very large. It's about the size of Italy, so the kind of notion of managing to do that across the whole reef is quite, you know, let's call it ambitious. But what's interesting is when you talk to the scientists doing this, they say, look, I mean, they'll say various things, but a lot of what they'll say is, this is something we can work on. We don't know if this is going to be scalable, but it's something we can work on. And it's something you find with all of those kind of reef scientists when you talk to them is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to them, was it seemed to me that they were in a kind of hyper-accelerated version of what's happening to the rest of us. They are watching the thing that they study essentially kind of die in front of them. And I wanted to find out what it was like to do that. How do you kind of psychologically think about that? And the thing that became really clear to me was that, first of all, 2016, the first really big bleaching event, was a really profound moment for lots of them, and lots of them changed their study or changed the things they were researching or moved to new areas of study after that because they felt like they had to do something. But that all of them engage in a kind of process where, you know, they know what's going on. They have no illusions of how dire the situation is. But what they do is they go, this is the thing I can do. This is the thing I can work on. And I can make this difference. And maybe, you know, maybe if I do this, it won't be the solution, but it will be part of a solution. Maybe we'll get lucky. You know, maybe we'll turn this around, you know, but what you can't do is kind of give up. And I found that actually a really inspiring thing to be around. This kind of notion that, you know, you just say, look, I'll put my head down and do what I can. In a situation where, you know, things look bad, you know, because, I mean, it is a kind of interesting way of thinking about the larger problem of what's going on around us.
Well, that kind of brings me in a way to my sort of final question. There's so much in this book where you talk about us being on the brink of cascade events with the, you know, the ice shelves collapsing, with the, you know, what's going to happen if krill, very resilient creatures, nevertheless, you know, can no longer continue to propagate and survive in the way they do. The absolutely, when we haven't talked about it, but the terrifying
prevalence everywhere of kind of pelagic plastics. And, you know, did you come away from writing this book essentially having depressed the hell out of yourself, or was there something you could find to take away from it? I mean, kind of how doomed are we?
Look, I wouldn't have said good news was in abundance at the moment, and I wouldn't have said that the last couple of weeks in the United States, I mean, you know, what's going on in America is obviously incredibly damaging on multiple fronts in this arena. What I would say is that, you know, there are positive things happening. I mean, the kind of shift to renewables is underway. Emissions haven't yet peaked, but they seem to be peaking. So even though we're now seeing higher climate sensitivity, we're seeing, you know, kind of actual carbon levels rising in the atmosphere, partly because of forest fires and things, you know, our emissions are actually kind of plateauing. And that is the first step towards going down. I mean, look, I think there's a lot in the book that's really difficult. And a lot of it was actually quite difficult to write about. I mean, I must say the first time I read through the second half, I kind of in one go, I found myself sitting there going, oof. But
you're me,
because yeah, you write it in pieces and then you read it in one go and you're like, oh, okay. But but what I would say is that the thing I really came away with the book was not about what we're losing. It's about how much is left. If that makes sense, it's that kind of sense that there is just this extraordinary kind of beauty and wonder and complexity in the world. And however much damage we've done to it, you know, however much damage we're going to do to it before we turn things around, that's still there and that's worth kind of fighting for. And it's like the, you know, it's like the stuff about carbon emissions. You know, I mean, looks like we've blasted through 1.5. I don't think that's a surprise to anybody. You know, we're on track for a lot more than that. But there is a big difference between 2.5 and 2. There's a big difference between 1.9 and 2, between 1.8 and 2. Like, you know, it's not over. It's never over. And that kind of push towards trying to do something about it is so important because there is so much left. And, you know, and there are so many. The kind of other thing I came away with was the kind of amazingness of people, if that makes sense. I mean, lots of people engage in a thing about kind of humans being, you know, humans are this kind of destructive force. And I don't think that's the case. I mean, I think certain of our economic arrangements are incredibly destructive, but, you know, humans have found ways to live sustainably within their environments at many points over history. And, you know, and we are, you know, kind of, the reason we need to turn this around is so that, you know, we can kind of save everybody. There's an amazing moment. The Barry Lopez's last book, Horizon, and there's a beautiful moment near the beginning of that, and he's sitting by a pool and he looks at these people and he says, all I want is for everybody to survive what's coming. And that seems to me to be kind of what our starting point should be. How do we get everybody through? How do we make a better world and one that kind of is capable of containing that kind of beauty and wonder and allowing it to go on around us?
James Bradley, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It was great.